Well, good evening. It's good to be with all of you again tonight. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is God, Yahweh is one. You shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, soul, and might. When Jesus, the wandering desert preacher, was asked what God's greatest command was, he did not pull out his Bible and look around and try to find a good verse. He also didn't just pull some arbitrary verse out of Deuteronomy 6. In fact, the previous chapter in Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 5, lists 10 commands. But he didn't choose one of those. He told them what all of the Jews knew to be the most significant verse in their scriptures. Many of them were wearing a copy of that verse right at that moment. And we don't know if it was bound on Jesus' hand and head, or if it was on the doorposts of his house, or for that matter, if he even had a house. But it probably was at one point. Mark 12:29, Jesus answered, "The foremost is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength." The man who asked him, Jesus, said, "That is right. He is one, and there is no one else beside him. All of this is better than burnt offerings." And Jesus responded, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." It is difficult to appreciate, I think, the monumental significance of this verse on the surface because of our Western modern culture. Religion is supposed to be something private and separate from the rest of your life. And we as Christians today are constantly battling this point. But what I want to talk to you about today are our idols. And I would argue that idols still exist, and this most important proclamation that Yahweh is God and Yahweh is one is still relevant. And the part at the end that we tend to focus on, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and might, is still, of course, relevant too. But I want to look mostly at that first part. And I want to point you to a recent experience I had, and hopefully, again, make this all the more relevant. I had the chance to visit the 10,000 or so acres of an ancient Roman city outside of Rome proper. It's called Ostia. And along with the theater and the baths and the fascinating mosaics, painted walls, and other history nerd things that I got to see there, I was struck by the pattern that I saw in every excavated home and building. They started digging this thing up about 100 years ago. And so in many of the rooms that they've dug up, you know, you have part of a room, you don't have a ceiling, of course, it's half a wall. But again and again and again, this pattern, this architectural pattern was there. There was this niche in the wall that was arched. It was always an arch, and it was always sort of inset into the wall. These were hearths to their household gods. The Romans had... of course, a lot of gods, the big ones that you think of in their pantheon, but there were sort of smaller, more protective, like ancestral spirits. Most of these little hearths would have been to the Lares, ancestral spirits, or the Penates, which were protective divinities of the house. After most meals, the father of the household would take a little bit of the dinner and sprinkle it up there on that hearth as a kind of offering to this protective spirit. There are, of course, also statues along the roads and at the crossroads, and those fill the museum and other museums. Well, what tied all of this together and sort of what sparked this lesson was that in the middle of this excavated Roman city of Ostia, I sort of stumbled across, because the map wasn't helpful and the signs weren't helpful, I stumbled upon a Jewish synagogue, not too far from the museum, actually. And not too much further down the road was a late 3rd or 4th century Christian basilica. And seeing those two buildings in the midst of that culture was striking. They simply didn't belong. It almost made me want to yell, as I'm sure they thought to or did, the ones that lived there, "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is God. Yahweh is one." You might say, well, of course, you know, where is this going? Why is this such a big deal? You know, you were in ancient Rome. We know they had lots of other gods. But we don't have Zeus or Vulcan or anything like that today. And to that I say, I'll come back to that point. So Israelites call this verse that Woody read for us and that I've read a couple of times now, the Shema, which is the first word in that sentence, the hear part. It means listen with the intent of obeying. And so what is the Shema saying? Well, those first two clauses, Yahweh is God, Yahweh is one, I want to look at for a moment. First, Yahweh, the living God, is God. Of course, Moses asked God what his name was, and he replied, "The I am that I am." Literally in Hebrew, how they would have heard it was simply, "He is," or "the one who is." And God told Moses that his name was not simply that to distinguish himself from all the gods who were not, although, of course, this name does that, but that their God is the living God, which is usually what the New Testament refers to him as. He is the ultimate life-giving reality. It is important to know that Yahweh, He is God. Moses asked him for his name, and the first, second, and third words of God spoken from the mountain of Mount Sinai in Exodus 20, or we usually call them the first, second, and third commandments, deal with his name. And the Jews became so afraid of pronouncing his name that they either forgot how, or depending on who you read, they were so pagan that they lost the pronunciation that way. I keep saying Yahweh. Yahweh is pretty close, we think. Jehovah is really not that close, although we sing it and it's in a lot of things. We get that from Latin translations, and we don't need to go into that here, but I don't think it's wrong to do one or the other either. But that is, of course, his proper name. The second part, Yahweh is one. Not many, like pagan Egyptians that the Israelites had experienced, or Romans, who all had gods for the sun, moon, stars, fire, months of the year, stormy weather, bad harvests, fertility, good luck, you name it. This has always, even now, the fact that he is one, set Jews and later followers of Jesus apart from the rest of humanity. The last part of the command you are most familiar with, you shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, soul, and might. So Moses, speaking for God here in Deuteronomy 6, said, "These words you shall bind," I'm paraphrasing because I want it to be in the order that I'm going to go through it here in a moment, but this is all there. "These words you shall bind in your hand, on your head, they should be in your heart, you should teach them to your household, and you shall place them on your house." And I want to look at each of these in turn. They all start with an H, so they're easy to remember that way. And we'll look at each of these in turn for just a moment. So, on your hand. That one, I think, is pretty obvious. All that you do, all your labor, all of your service, who are you working for? Where is your might being spent, men? Is it for you or for the one you serve? I thought of this because I was there at one point. Young men, with your first job, is the name of Yahweh bound around your hand as you work, or do you only do the bare minimum of what is required? For all of us, by whose power do you do what you do? It should be bound around your head. Of course, this is all you think. It's your intellectual center, your knowledge. Who is the source of wisdom for you? Where do you turn for intellectual stimulation and enlightenment? It should be in your heart. Jews physically wore these things. They still do. They wrap them around their hand, or they wrap them around their head. And the piece that wrapped around their head, there was actually a piece that hung down over their heart. The heart, of course, is the core of your being. Who do you honor above all? And who is enthroned there? It talks about your household. This one didn't start with an H in Scripture, so I had to add that a little bit. But household. The passage says to fathers to instruct their children in these things. Your children, of course, are the ultimate proof of who you are. They see all you do for good and bad. This message has never meant so much to me now as it once did. I have two little pairs of eyes on me all the time. And we think about that usually as sort of a negative thing. They see all the bad things that I do, which is true. My son's a parrot at times, and he echoes it back, what I say. But, positively, this passage, I think, is a little bit more positive. Do your kids know who you are and who you serve? And then your house, your physical, the physical place that you live. You think about where you go as you leave it, and even when you're not there, it declares to the rest of the neighborhood who your family serves. Today, Jews mark off their physical homes with something called a mezuzah, which some of you have probably seen attached to the doorposts. Jews look at it, touch it, or maybe kiss their fingers and touch it as they leave the house. It's a constant physical reminder of who they serve as they leave. I did this on a certain level. I'm kind of a nerd, as many of you know. And so I was thinking about all of this a lot over the last couple of years. And I wore actually a leather armband for a while. And some of you asked me about it because I was wearing it nonstop for about 6 months. And I simply wrote the Hebrew letters for Yahweh on it, his name bound around my wrist. And that's not kosher by any means, like literally or figuratively, with what the Jews do. I don't know where the leather came from or anything. But it was interesting, you know, the reactions that I got from people here who were asking me about it, from comments like, you know, that's cool, to that's a little strange. I had a fascinating conversation with a guy in Famous Footwear about it at one point, who said it was cool. So, but you know, it was an interesting experience for all those reasons, starting conversations. But of course, the most important part for me was what it did for me, you know, personally. The conversations were great, but in many ways, you know, one of the best benefits of it was that it was very difficult to sin with that hand or the other, for that matter, with the name of God written on it. And it didn't hold some kind of magical powers. There's nothing special or miraculous about that. But it reminded me of the great and living God that I serve. And it certainly impacted some of the decisions that I made. I want to make just a slight detour here and point out something about the scriptures that you might not have seen before. You might have a kind of overall negative impression. There's a lot of words like commandments, even in the verses that we read sort of surrounding this one. And even these, thinking about these physical things that Jews did then and do now. And so we can be confused or upset about contemporary practice or some wrong impression of Judaism in the past. But I think we too often think of the old law as some kind of dead, obligatory custom following. Yes, there were physical customs, and many of them were obligatory, but many of them were also very good. And God did not give them and stand back and say, now obey, because I told you so. There actually is specific motivation for why they should obey and do these things here in Deuteronomy 6. And following it is actually very similar to ours. He says here in a couple of places that Yahweh, this God that they're called on to serve, redeemed you from the house of slavery, he says. And so in the same way, we have that motivator. He redeemed us. He has bought us from the house of slavery. They and we owe him more than reluctant obedience. Deuteronomy 13, several chapters later, lays out a kind of multi-stage level of responding to this one true and living God. Just a couple verses here. Deuteronomy 13, 3 and 4. You shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams. That's the context. For the Lord your God, Yahweh your God, is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You shall follow the Lord your God and fear him, and you shall keep his commandments, listen to his voice, serve him, and cling to him. You know, do you associate that with sort of Old Testament practices that we often think of as maybe a little bit cold or rigid? So that's this Shema, that's this greatest command according to Jesus. And so thinking about the Roman practices of idolatry and perhaps our own, who are the idols you serve instead of this great, living, one and only God? Well, I haven't been to all of your houses, and many of you haven't been to mine, but my guess is that if I went over to your house tonight after services, I wouldn't find that little alcove etched into your family room with a statue of Heracles or Vulcan in it. You won't be lighting a piece of incense to your God tonight, but I might argue that you might be doing the modern-day equivalent. Timothy Keller wrote a book called Counterfeit Gods, addressing this topic. And the subtitle of that work lets you know his list. He says, Counterfeit Gods, subtitle, The Empty Promises of Money, Sex, and Power, and the Only Hope That Matters. I've heard others call idolatry simply addiction. Paul calls covetousness or greediness idolatry. I'd like to both kind of unify all of these ideas and simplify them for you so that you can identify your idols. I think it comes down to, what do you do when you are afraid? What do you do when you are sad? What do you do when you are simply discontent? And what do you do, most importantly, when you feel out of control? The list that I came up with, which there are many others, and I think probably some of these are a little trivial, but the list that I came up with for our modern-day incense or small scraps of food after dinner sounded like this. Let's go to the mall and shop. Let's go get ice cream and watch a movie. I'm worried I need to take an extra job. We'd be happier if only we bought that nicer car. We can't go there or do that. It wouldn't be safe. I need, and you need, to take this health supplement or do that diet or only eat a certain type of food. I have to watch that show or that game, or I need some me time. Well, what is one thing each of these examples has in common? There's several things, and it's just it's a short list. I think for me, when I think about it, it all comes down to who is in control of your life. One of those examples might have made you feel a little angry at me or defensive. One of those made me feel angry and defensive, but we'll come back to that in a moment. So how do we rid ourselves of these idols? Well, first, in all things, I think we need to think about how Jesus fits into this picture. He is the way, the truth, and the life, after all. And so how has he provided a way out of modern-day idolatry? Well, Jesus, like Moses, gave a few words of his own from a mountain. And we don't call what I'm about to refer to as the three commandments, but I don't know that you'd be wrong in doing that. The king you have expressed allegiance to declared these to you, his people, with really no qualifications. And my guess is that, because I never saw it this way, that many of you have never seen these as commands, but just as a part of his Sermon on the Mount. So if you would, turn over to Matthew 6, we're going to look at a couple verses here. There, of course, is much more to his Sermon on the Mount than the few verses that I'm going to highlight here, but I think these might be of use to you, especially when we think about this. So beginning in verse 1 of chapter 6 in Matthew, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them, otherwise you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven," which is sort of the big picture context of this, the subsequent verses. So verse 2, "So when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be honored by men. Truly I say to you that they have their reward in full. But when you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you." Verse 5, "When you pray, you are not to be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners, so that they may be seen by men. Truly I say to you that they have their reward in full. But you, when you pray, go into your inner room, close your door, and pray to your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And when you pray, do not use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do, for they suppose that they will be heard for their many words. So do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him." And then jumping to verse 16, "When you fast, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do, for they neglect their appearance so they will be noticed by men when they are fasting. Truly I say to you that they have their reward in full. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, so that by your fasting, so that your fasting will not be noticed by men, but your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret, will reward you." Give, pray, fast is the list that I come up with that. You know, really, is that what we're supposed to do? It has to be more complicated, natural, easy, or even just normal than that. I don't even really know anything about this book, but one of the popular mantras of the day, even in some religious circles, is eat, pray, love, right? Well, one is the opposite, eat and fast. Those don't really go hand in hand. One is the same, pray and pray, and one is pretty vague, just sort of love. which makes sense in our culture. But another difference about that mantra is that it's about you, right? Well, give, pray, fast is not about you. And the only one that you could think might be is the pray part. But if you look at what Jesus says here about how you should pray, you know, don't pray with vain repetition about yourself, Jesus says. God knows what you need. So what are you supposed to pray about? Well, the verses that I skipped are, of course, the Lord's Prayer, the model prayer. That's what he tells us to praise God as God. Pray that he brings his kingdom to us. Pray that he might sustain us in another day, in order that we might lean on him for more. And pray for forgiveness when we fail. So nobody generally thinks this, except for our culture, that you can sort of fit Jesus into a cool, modern, savvy sort of TED talker of his day. You know, think again. Give, pray, fast. Those are still pretty radical solutions to the human condition. And they're still just as unpopular as on the hillside in Galilee. And there are still two gates, as Jesus says a few verses later, the wide and the narrow. So when you are fearful, pray. When you are worried, fast. When you are discontent, give. And when you feel out of control, don't try to reclaim that control. Acknowledge the one who is in control. This is not intended to be a lesson to leave you feeling as though you just need to try harder, or do better, or study more, or just be a better Christian. I think we hear those, not intentionally, but we hear that message, and the guilt we experience from those types of lessons doesn't really last very long, if you hadn't noticed. The Jews were reminded of why they served the great I Am, or He Is, above Baal or Ra, or any other god that might have competed with him coming out of Egypt. It was because he saved them. He bought them when they were slaves, and he set them free in a land that he prepared for them. You too have that kind of motivation, especially made all the more powerful when you look at who is at the center of it. And so when you fall back on your idols to get you through a tough day, or a fearful situation, or for good luck, for a good harvest, whatever the modern day equivalent of that is, what should you do? My point earlier about those examples, about the mall and the ice cream, etc., was not to make you think that because you do those things, you must be worshiping idols. My point in this whole sermon, the big point, is idolatry still exists, but our Western culture, as I mentioned, makes you think that our heart is separate from our head. Or to put it another way, religion is supposed to be something we do because we feel like it, but that is to be totally separate from how we live day to day. Well, I tell you, not because I'm smarter than our culture, but because God is. He understands how we work. And he knows that we are prone to serving other gods, whether we have little statues to them in our living room or not. He also knows that we are prone to want to serve him using the elements of our culture that are the most comfortable to us, just like the Israelites did with the golden calf. So, more than anything else, I want you to hear that though your idols have no name or statue, you are serving them when you are not serving him. So again, what should you do? Well, as I mentioned, there's a reason, there's a motivator. Focus on Jesus. He gives us a new heart as part of the new covenant that is capable of loving Yahweh, our God, with all our heart, soul, and strength. This ultimately was the part that the Israelites struggled with. Yes, the rules and all of the sort of the duties that went along that was difficult. But that's the part they really struggled with when you read through the prophets. And it's the same part that we struggle with now. But Jesus is the way. And you can breathe being animated by the Spirit of God and create life in this dead world with his help, though your body on its own is full of corruption and sin. So focus on Jesus. Focus on his death. It gives you cleansing. And it's not just surface level washing, as we know in our minds, but his death is powerful enough to reach into the darkest parts of your life and into the darkest corners of your heart, the things that you lust after when nobody's watching. And he can cleanse your conscience. His death is powerful enough to cleanse your very conscience. And focus, of course, on his resurrection and be filled with hope. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is God, Yahweh is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and might. We like to conclude with an invitation. And so I invite you tonight to a life different from those around you. I invite you to a life of fulfillment. And I invite you to join us, who are here, in a life of worship.